There's a new book out from Martin Giesbrecht called Before I Forget, and he's here in the studio with me. Thanks for being here.
Well, I'm delighted.
Now, let me start off. First off, your full name is on the book cover.
Right.
Gerhard, you don't use your middle name normally. I mean, for years we've heard your commentaries on the radio, but without the middle name. So why are you going the full Monty this time?
I don't know why. It began with the first book I published in economics, and I used the name because it filled up the front of the book so nicely. And it's also a long family tradition. All the males have had Gerhard in their name somehow or another. It's a thing that goes back to the old country. So I decided to put it in always on the titles of the books that I have.
Okay, and I wanted to mention that too, because a lot of people listening to us now have probably heard you over the years on other radio stations, public radio stations here in town. You've also had pieces on NPR and PRI, so we want to make sure that people know it's the real Martin Giesbrecht.
None other than.
In this book, you talk about a lot of events, but they're not really big events. Most of them are small, everyday, can I use the word mundane even?
Yes. Oh, yes. That is the whole idea. Those are the events that I think make our lives, and they are the meat and potatoes of our lives, all these little events, and if we pay attention to them, it enriches our lives.
Well, let's talk about a few of them. I picked out a number of them to talk about, and one that caught me right off was a piece about going to your job every day, commuting with Wolfgang Mozart. Now, one of the things that we should mention, too, is that you are a musician. You play the clarinet. And for most of us, commuting with Mozart would mean that you're in the car and there's a piece of Mozart on the radio. But
right.
For you, that became something more.
Well, you know, I grew up in a German-speaking household in New Jersey. And my parents were immigrants. They came over in the early 1920s. So I'm quite fluent in German. I have my doctoral degree from the University of Munich. And the idea of having an actual conversation with the Mozart who comes and sits next to me in the passenger seat, like I said in the story, beam me down Scotty fashion, suddenly there's the Wolfgang Amadeus sitting right there, amused me. The idea of it amused me. And I was coming to the end of a 40-year teaching career, and I loved every year of it, and I enjoyed every student that I've ever had. There are many thousands of them. But I was beginning to get to be been there, done that, if you know how that can be in a life as long as mine. And I was really counting the semesters as they were ticking by to the very end when I was looking forward to retirement. And I think that makes you a little bit spacey, perhaps. But the idea of driving to work in my 94 diesel Rabbit along 275, along that cement corridor where you get glimpses of Cincinnati skyline to the left as you're going to work from Villa Hills to the NKU campus. And having Mozart sitting there was amazing. And I always thought, what would he imagine in this modern world of ours? And I think what he would be particularly tickled by wouldn't be some of the outrageous technology that we have, but really he was, in my imagination, he was taken by the air conditioner in the car and by the windshield wipers and also by the radio. And he would make me sit in the parking lot and finish out a particular selection that I was listening to on WGUC, which I do anyhow, with or without Mozart sitting next to me. And by the way, I'm not crazy. I know there really was not a Mozart sitting there.
Another car story you had in here was a car chase in a 1937 DeSoto.
Oh, yes, beautiful. It was a beautiful black car, a four-door sedan. The 1937 DeSoto, by the way, is an iconic model. Hot rodders always want to salvage the bumpers off of those cars. They are a unique, beautiful steel bumpers, and you'll see them on hot rod shows, 1937 DeSoto. And my friend George Egbert, my high school friend from New Jersey, had one, which he doted on. And yes, indeed, we're coming home too fast at 2 o'clock in the morning. And way in the back, there was a cop car, and we noticed the lights going on. Those were the days when they had a single red light that would blink on and off. We tried to outrun it, and actually we succeeded. And this was one of my great criminal successes.
Another thing that we find out about you, you had a story about smoking a pipe underage.
I was 6 years old. And
Okay, I'm, you know, underage. I mean, that's way underage.
Major underage. By the way, I've never smoked in my life except a celebrative cigar if somebody has a baby. And when I was 6 years old, this pipe with my friend Freddie, who was older than I. It was one of those family friend things. You know, my parents were friends with Freddie's parents, and they visited back and forth. And I often stayed for a couple of days at Freddie's house. And during that time, he introduced me to the wiles of an older brother, a sort of a surrogate brother. Part of that was going to see my first movie, which was a double-featured movie of The Invisible Man and The Smiling Ghost, both horror movies.
That was The Invisible Man with Claude Rains?
Yes.
Oh, that's a great one.
That,
yeah.
That ended up being a classic. You can see it on the late-night TV. The Smiling Ghost was not a classic, but it was really scary. And on the way out of the theater, we decided to buy pipes at the little kiosk outside the theater. And the cheapest pipe that I got there, I think 15 cents or something, and it was mine. And Freddie and I stole the tobacco from his dad, and we went into the woods by the Rahway River in New Jersey and smoked. And then the funny thing was, well, as you read in the story, I had to go home, and we always hid our pipes in a hollow tree in the woods. So I thought I was going to bid goodbye to that pipe. And I get home, and my aunt, Freddie's mother, who packed my suitcase, because at 6 years old, I didn't know from packing suitcases. So she packed my suitcase, and I come home, and my mother opens up my suitcase and takes out all my clothes. And there, wrapped up in tissue paper, was my pipe. And how Mrs. Hines, the mother of Freddie, knew about that pipe and knew how to fetch it out of the hollow tree. It must have asked Freddie or something. Anyhow, I was really surprised, and so was my mother.
When did you decide to start thinking about all these incidents in your life, remembering them, and to write them down and to share them?
Well, my wife, Patricia Berlin, died about 13 years ago now. And I have become very close with a woman named Victoria Bernardini, whom I travel with and with whom I have long car trips and short ones, too. Since she's never heard or known of these stories, I would tell them to her. Unfortunately, I would tell them to her again and again. And she would say, "You've told me that story 3, 4, 5 times. I've heard it already." And I thought, well, one way of stenching that flow, that repetitive flow, would be to write them down once and for all, and that's really how it started. But the main reason was these little short stories are five-finger exercises for me. They keep my writing going. I'm still actively writing serious economic pieces, and if I don't practice writing using words, putting them on the page, I feel I might lose it, just like if I don't practice my scales on the piano and practice the same thing on my clarinet, I would lose that. Here's one of the stories that I've written in the book. Clarinets don't feature much in American country music, but the Adams Brothers from rural Greenfield, Ohio, a quintessential country band, electric guitar, electric bass, pedal steel and drums, hired me now and then to play clarinets and sax with them when they had to mix standard dance music tunes into their usual country repertoire. These mixed affairs were called 50-50 dances and were quite popular in the outlying villages and towns at the time. I was always pleased when a short, thin, worn-out-looking fellow we knew as Don Lytle came in to sing a few slow country tunes with the band. He had a deep, clear voice that powerfully told of the hardships and heartbreaks which are the meat and potatoes of country music. When he sang, I'd be inspired to join in and play a chorus of similar and appropriate lament on my clarinet. He approved and said I played the best country clarinet he'd ever heard, probably the only one he'd ever heard. My association with the Adams Brothers lasted only a year or three, and I never played with Don Lytle again. He, however, went on to drug and alcohol abuse, several terms in jail, and fame. His big 1977 hit, Take This Job and Shove It, perfectly expressed the widespread economic dissatisfaction of the time. By then, he was known nationally as Johnny Paycheck.
Before I forget, it's written by Martin Giesbrecht, who was with us. And thank you very much for sharing all this, both in the book and with me.
Well, I'm delighted. I'm especially delighted to meet you face to face for the first time.
Well, thank you very much. And for Around Cincinnati, I'm Frank Johnson.